Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show where we discuss a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our subject today is one that may be familiar to you if you are of a certain age, or maybe if you are of a certain race. Well, that sounds strange, doesn't it? It's one of those subjects that, well, you're more or less aware of depending upon who you are. But most of you have probably heard of it. So here it is. We're going to talk about Jim Crow. Jim Crow. Now, if you think that Jim Crow is a person, well, you're sort of right. If you think Jim Crow is something else, well, you're right as well. In either event, Jim Crow is a subject that has an enormous amount of constitutional significance. I'll be talking to two people today on this very unsettling subject. The first of them is a colleague of mine at the Appalachian School of Law. His name is Derek Howard. And then later I'll be talking to James W. Lowen, who's recently written a book about one aspect of Jim Crow that you may not even be aware of, something called Sundown Towns. But let's start with Derek. Derek is a marvelous fellow. He is a colleague of mine at the Appalachian School of Law, where he teaches several courses, property, real estate transactions, natural resources, who knows, maybe even something else these days. He is a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh Law School. He practiced for a number of years, including at the very prestigious firm of Kirkpatrick and Lockhart in Pittsburgh. And then he came to the Appalachian School of Law, where he's sharing his years of experience and his scholarly interests with us. Speaking of his scholarly interests, he's recently written an article on 21st century human trafficking. You heard that right. Slavery in the 21st century. And as part of his scholarly background and as part of his personal experience, he knows a great deal about Jim Crow. Well, thanks for being with us, Derek.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing extremely well, and I appreciate you coming in today. So who was this fellow Jim Crow?
Stuart, there was no fellow named Jim Crow.
It wasn't a guy.
Uh-huh. It was a fictitious character. Actually, it originated from a song.
Really?
And because of that song, this minstrel performer, Thomas Daddy Rice, started to perform in his minstrel act in 1830. And by the 1850s, it had taken on a personification. It had taken on a ugly personification of racial hatred. And it actually just became synonymous with calling African Americans a derogatory term.
Really?
Similar to calling someone, I'll just say, the N-word.
Right. So they would use that as an actual epithet.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I didn't realize that.
Yes. And so, and actually, I would say that Jim Crow, I can't think of any other fictitious character that has cast as long a shadow over American history since that time. Mm-hmm. And it continues to cast a shadow over American history today. But going back to the origin of Jim Crow, mm-hmm. Jim Crow then went from a derogatory term to becoming a system of discrimination that was initially started in 1883 when the Supreme Court passed a ruling that the Civil Rights Act of 1875 was unconstitutional.
Okay, now let me put this a little bit in context.
Sure.
Of course, we had slavery for 400 years.
Mm-hmm.
We had a war that mm-hmm. was largely caused by the slavery issue.
Correct.
The Union won the war. The 13th Amendment was passed along with the 14th
yes.
and the 15th. And the
yes.
13th abolished slavery.
Yes.
The 14th contained important provisions like equal protection.
Right.
No state shall discriminate against people or deprive anyone of equal protection of the laws. The 15th specifically protected voting rights for former slaves.
Right.
But that's the key, former slaves. So you've got this huge population of former slaves in the South. And, of course, of free black people, free African Americans in other parts of the country. And now the question becomes, how do you integrate those people into society? How do you give them the rights of citizenship? And it was in reaction to that that Congress passed the act that you just mentioned, the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which,
right.
for the uninitiated, it's astonishing
I mean, for the first time I read it, I said, wait a second, this looked like a 1960s Civil Rights Act.
Correct, correct.
It did. Well, do you want to describe the sorts of things it did?
That particular the portion of the act that the Supreme Court attacked was the right to equal accommodations.
Yeah, public accommodations.
Correct.
It basically said you couldn't discriminate against people at restaurants or at hotels.
Correct.
And this is very important because the Equal Protection Clause has been interpreted consistently, and you're about to talk about that, but it does say no state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws.
Right.
But this law went beyond regulating governments. It regulated private individuals
right.
who wanted to privately discriminate. But I've gotten a little bit out of order because before the 1875 Civil Rights Act was passed, it was actually passed in reaction to the Black Codes. Tell us about that.
Well, after the Civil War and during the Reconstruction era, there was a lot of backlash or negative reaction by the South to what the federal government was attempting to do to give rights to African Americans. As a result, what were these bodies of laws, these statutes, were passed by different states. I think Mississippi was the first one, and they were called the Black Codes. And what they did was they attempted to deny rights to economic and physical rights to African Americans,
mm-hmm.
Preventing them from doing certain things like living in certain places, having certain jobs. But they were essentially they were dealt with by passage of, by the federal government of the 14th and 15th Amendment. And also the Civil Rights Act. So by 1883, going back to where we kind of started,
mm-hmm.
When the Supreme Court said, no, this is unconstitutional, that sort of lit a fuse, I'll say, that continued to fuel different issues between the races and supporting segregation.
Okay, before I let you go on, I have to put the chronology, make sure I've got it straight. Slavery, Civil War, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, and during a period we call Reconstruction. And the one thing we've left out is that during Reconstruction, there was a big question as to when or if former Confederates would regain their own ability to vote and run for office.
Right.
For a number of years, most of them didn't have that ability. But then in very controversial period of time, lots of pardons were issued, and
right.
gradually, bit by bit, the old Confederates basically regained political control.
Correct.
And when they regained that political control, then they started passing these Black Codes. Congress passes the Civil Rights Act of 1875 in response to that. Then we get to 1883, and in a very infamous case called the Civil Rights Cases, because it was a lot of different cases conglomerated together,
right.
the Supreme Court essentially held that the 1875 Civil Rights Act was unconstitutional because the Equal Protection Clause and other parts of the 14th Amendment only applied to governments, what we call state action. And so when the Congress tried to regulate private discrimination, it was unable to do so.
And I think this is one of the worst periods of Supreme Court decisions on the issues of discrimination. Because it led to legalized separation of the races
mm-hmm.
for so many years. And, of course, the Supreme Court's negative legacy continued in 1896 when it passed the Plessy v. Ferguson decision,
mm-hmm.
saying that separate but equal was legal. And as a result, there were a lot of states that then began to enact laws, more laws. Now, the Black Codes had been dealt with by this point in time, but now this was a green light for them to continue to operate laws that prevented them or didn't require them to do various things. And there was a decision even before that, I think it was Cummings versus the Richmond Board of Education in Georgia, where they ruled that the state did not have to provide any education to blacks as long as they can prove economic hardship or financial hardship, that they could, in fact, provide an education for white students, but because they didn't have the money, to provide education for black students, they didn't have to do so. So
if you're going to economize, just cut the black kids out of the equation.
Yeah, and you can do it for political reasons or racial reasons and discriminatory reasons, and just put a veil over it and say that it's because we can't afford to. So a lot of school districts started, particularly in the South, started to not even provide them with education. Again, as I said, the Jim Crow cast a very long shadow.
And so this emerging system that started with the Black Codes, a system of actual legal discrimination directed at former slaves, African Americans, came to get that name, Jim Crow.
Yes.
So that's interesting. So what began as a racial epithet, or began as a song, became an epithet, and now is being described an entire political and economic system.
Right.
And that you mentioned a moment ago that the race relations were horrible then. I think that's often this era, this late 19th century, early 20th century, is often called the nadir, or the low point of race relations in this country.
Right.
Isn't that interesting?
Right.
It's 30, 40 years after slavery ends that things get their worst.
Yeah. Well, I recently wrote an article concerning 21st century slavery. So there still are people who are enslaved, and there's still people who are being treated in an inequitable manner as a result of those historic roots. And I actually would argue that the Arizona laws concerning immigration are a continued reflection of an attempt to marginalize people.
So if we're up to, let's say, the 1890s, early 1900s, what happens with Jim Crow? I mean, when does it get challenged? How does it ultimately get dismantled, or does it get dismantled?
Well, it eventually does get dismantled through the Brown versus Board of Education decision.
But that's 1954. Yeah.
Well, for a number of years, blacks suffered under this body of law.
So it just nothing happened for the most part.
No, no.
Nothing happened in terms of dismantling it. I mean, it was pretty solid.
It was pretty solid.
Yeah.
In fact, the Shelley v. Kramer was a case that was issued by the Supreme Court in the 1940s. I always get it confused between 1946 and 1943.
Well, we'll spot you the 3 years, one
thank
way or the other.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. But that was a decision in which the Supreme Court essentially said that racial covenants or restrictive covenants that were included in deeds between parties were enforceable.
Okay, now let's make sure we understand.
Make sure I'm saying it correctly.
Unenforceable. Right, but that was relatively late. Let's explain that for people who are not realtors or real estate people. In a deed, you can actually put something called a restrictive covenant, and oftentimes these are good things. You can't erect a feedlot on this property, or you can't put a nuclear waste dump on this property, and so they protect property interests, and they go beyond just one owner. They run with the land, as we say, and so they go in the deeds, they go in the record books. But some of those restrictive covenants were racial.
Right. Going back to back in time, that the effects of the Jim Crow laws, effectively created these separate communities, and it was legal in every level of society,
right,
to separate one race from another and not give protection to the race that was deemed inferior,
right,
and marginalized, and that's what occurred from that period of time, well into the 50s and the 60s, leading to the civil rights movement. But part of what happened after 1896 was that...
That was the date of Plessy versus Ferguson,
correct,
you mentioned before, okay.
The states and federal government failed to give protection to any, to African Americans on a number of fronts, and it became a part of everyday life. It wasn't just what happened in the court systems or what happened in Congress. It was a part of everyday life. My father was born in 1923 in Little Rock, Arkansas, and he told me that he had to cross the street whenever he walked down the main street, because if there was a white person there, he was required to cross the street or, face being beaten in the street. And this is a man who served in World War II in Korea, and is decorated, and he had to endure that. It was part of everything. The textbooks that we were given, or blacks were given at that time, they told false stories about history and excluded African Americans completely from some textbooks. I mean, Malcolm X in his book says how his school teachers try to tell him that he would never amount to anything and that he should just quit school, period. The shadow of Jim Crow lives in my house for sure.
Sure. Just your dad, I think you told me, recently passed away.
That's correct.
But that was only recently. So right up until just a couple of years ago, there was someone living in your family who had actually experienced this, who was born right in the middle of all of this.
Yes. Yeah.
When he grew up, he actually had the law on the side of discrimination.
Yeah. And both of my parents are Southerners. So I know what it did to impact their opportunity. The board versus Board of Education decision, of course, overturned Plessy. But we still had to wait until Rosa Parks did what she did.
Yeah, that's very important. So let's get the dates again. So you mentioned your dad born in the 1920s. And the Klan, in fact, had its great resurgence in the 1920s. You know, there was a period after the Civil War when it was very prominent that it was sort of reformed and reached its resurgence in the 1920s. But then you mentioned something else that's very important. Your dad went off and served in World War II. And he served in Korea. And many historians say that return of those veterans who had gone off and sacrificed for the country and had been treated, certainly not equally, but perhaps better in the military than they'd been treated at home in many instances.
Sure.
When they came home, that was the moment at which the modern civil rights era really began.
Exactly.
And it was a sort of a culmination, not a complete culmination, but an extremely important watershed moment about 10 years later in Brown. So could you talk about that? Did your dad ever talk about how things had changed, if at all, when he came back from World War II?
As with a lot of, or at least many of the black war veterans of World War II that I personally have known in my life, they never talk about it.
Hmm.
They never talk about the war because they don't want to relive that experience. They never talk about the treatment they received because they don't want to relive that experience either. It took quite some time. And my father had me much later in life. So it took quite some time before we even had that conversation. I didn't know anything about his service until probably within the last 12 years.
Really?
That's really when he would say something about it. So no one talked about that. But if you can look at public figures, and if you know their stories, then you know the experience. Joe Louis, I'm a big boxing fan. So
right.
Joe Louis served in the Army during World War II. And when he came home, the treatment that he received, I mean, the IRS made sure it emptied his pockets, and for doing things that, as far as I know, weren't any different than what anybody else had done at that time. And he continued boxing, of course, losing at least a couple of his last fights. And then he became a doorman at a casino.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. We're asking the question today, who was Jim Crow? Or, more appropriately, what was Jim Crow? After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll continue our discussion with Professor Derek Howard of the Appalachian School of Law.
Listen, all you girls and boys, I'm just from Tucky Hole. I'm trying to sing a little song, my name's Jim Crow. Wheel about and turn about and do just so. Every time I wheel about, I jump Jim Crow. I went down to the river, I didn't mean to stay. But there I see so many guys, I couldn't get away. Wheel about and turn about and do just so. Every time I wheel about, I jump Jim Crow. And roll around the middle.
Once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz. And on the line is Kelly Carmichael, our quiz lady.
Hello, Stuart. How are you?
I'm doing extremely well. And I understand today we have a contestant, Chester, from Cedar Bluff, Virginia. Chester, are you there?
Yes, sir.
All righty. Well, Kelly, do you have a tough question for Chester from Cedar Bluff?
I do, and especially with the yes, sir, he's being so polite. I love it.
We love polite contestants. All right. Well, let's give him a very polite question then.
All right. Well, Chester, I'm gonna read you a quote from one of the Federalist Papers, Federalist number 51, from our good friend James Madison. And the question that goes along with the quote is, which of these principles is best reflected in the excerpt? Which of these principles best reflected in the Federalist paper that I'm going to read to you? And your answer choices will be majority rule, popular sovereignty, limited government, and a representative democracy. All right, so here is James Madison in Federalist number 51, a very great quote from James Madison. Sure. In creating a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, make it control itself.
Oh, that's a good quote. So that's a quote from James Madison writing Federalist number, what, 56, you said?
51.
51. So James Madison, we often forget that James Madison wrote a number of the Federalist Papers. Hamilton wrote most of them, but Madison was in second place and wrote many of the most important ones. And so that was a quote from James Madison in the Federalist, and now we want to ask which of those four principles that quote best reflects. And what were the four principles again?
Sure. They were majority rule, popular sovereignty, limited government, or representative democracy.
Okay. Chester, do you have an idea of which of those four principles is best reflected in that statement from James Madison?
Well, let's see. In that excerpt, you get an emphasis on control and governing the population, but then also control itself, which I guess reflects the idea of the population, self-governance, or whatnot. I'm going to go with popular sovereignty an answer? B?
Popular sovereignty, answer choice B. Well, just so everyone can play along, what were the answer choices again?
Sure. Majority rule, popular sovereignty, limited government, and representative democracy.
Okay. And then read the quote one last time, if you
will. Sure. In creating a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, have it control itself.
Wow, and it's a tough act to follow. I mean, it's a tough balancing act to achieve. Okay, so once again, Chester, which one do you think it best reflects, that quote?
Well, it didn't say anything about, just the 51% being the way that things should be governed. So I want to rule out A. Popular sovereignty, when you get the notion of, men over men and control itself, but when it says control itself, do they mean like the population controlling the government and limiting the government, or a government representative of the population, or...
I don't want to give you too much help, but my sense of this, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kelly, is that the second part of the quote talks about government limiting itself, right?
Yes.
Okay, so first of all, you have to control people, but then the government has to control itself.
Okay, well, that helps. And okay, well, I want to go with C then, limited government.
Limited government. Okay, Kelly, how did he do?
You have green lights. Congratulations. You have won a T-shirt, my friend Chester.
Tremendous. Chester gets it. And that was legitimate, I think, for us to sit and think about what that quote meant, because that was a tough quote, an important quote, about two related concepts and then some very good answer choices. So, Chester, you're to be congratulated. You got the right answer.
Oh,
you're speechless. Will you wear your T-shirt with pride?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, absolutely. Well then you go and you pick your T-shirt, and thank you for playing.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. We're discussing Jim Crow with Professor Derek Howard of the Appalachian School of Law.
As a result of the Civil Rights Movement, monumental passage of laws, as you said, the Civil Rights Act during the 60s, reflected what they were trying to do in 1875.
Well, let's not skip over Brown. We've mentioned Brown several times, but let's talk about it. 1954, a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court, which
yes.
is extraordinary.
Argued by Thurgood Marshall.
Argued by Thurgood Marshall, very good. In fact, twice, right? I think they had two arguments. The Supreme Court, by An act of enormous fate or providence, whatever you prefer, had just gotten a new Chief Justice Earl Warren, who was determined not only to overturn segregation, but to do it unanimously.
Yeah.
So he overturned segregation. Now, technically, Brown only overturned it in public primary school children's education, public school education.
Right.
But it really was seen and ultimately was interpreted as being a repudiation of all legal or de jure, if you want to use a fancy term, segregation in the United States. But on the one hand, enormously important decision. On the other hand, it prompted what's commonly called massive resistance.
Right.
Primarily, not exclusively, primarily in the South, but lots of other places in the United States as well. In fact, people often forget that the Board of Education in the Brown case was from Topeka, Kansas.
Right.
And there were a number of other boards of education, too, and that's not the Old South. So, you know, discrimination was not confined to the Old Confederacy. So that massive resistance, in turn, of course, necessitates what we often consider to be the Rosa Parks era, the civil rights era, the modern civil rights era. So now that we put that in context, you obviously have some things to say about that as well.
Well, what I can say is that I consider myself a child of the civil rights era. I was born in 65.
A mere child.
Uh-huh. But, you know, because of the Supreme Court's final recognition that separate but equal was not equal, in order to actually obtain those rights, the civil rights era or movement began to fight against as a response to white resistance to finally recognizing that what had been done historically for so many years was discriminatory and unlawful. You know, a lot of people give Rosa Parks credit for starting the civil rights, you know, movement, her act of defiance, and I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. But, of course, Martin Luther King picked up that banner.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other blacks at that time, black leaders at that time, who, you know, decided that they were going to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, there were a number who stepped up and started their own individual campaigns to support the civil rights movement, like Malcolm X,
right.
Like Stokely Carmichael,
right.
And some would say like the Black Panthers, although eventually the government put a crackdown on some of those that they considered militant. Luckily, the civil rights movement took flight in the form of Martin Luther King, was successful.
Mm-hmm. And the nonviolent perspective. And there was quite a split in the African-American community.
I mean,
there were people who wanted to take a more confrontational, if not necessarily militant, approach.
Like Stokely Carmichael,
right.
and the Black Panthers.
Right. And then, but as you say, King's approach was at least the primary approach. And that ultimately is what prevailed.
Yeah, and I think it prevailed because it humanized African Americans in a way that the average white American citizen, I believe, could see that what was going on was wrong and that it was time for a change. So much had started to change, particularly after the 1950s and the McCarthy era and just government strangling of independence.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, there were a number of groups that were ready to be heard. And, of course, the war in Vietnam didn't help in the politics of the time. Of course, there was the female rights movement was there.
Oh, sure. I mean, the 60s was such a remarkable era because there were so many different issues that came to the head at the same time. But you mentioned something a moment ago that I don't want to skip over either, and that's the extraordinarily important 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Right.
Now, and there's a lot of constitutional issues there that go back to where we started with the civil rights cases. You mentioned the civil rights cases in 1883 had said that the Equal Protection Clause, among other parts of the Constitution, could not be used to regulate private discrimination.
Right.
So recognizing that and not wanting to take on that old ruling, President Johnson and ultimately the Congress at that time in the early 1960s, authorized an act in 1964 that was remarkably similar to the 1875 Act.
Right.
I won't say it was a reenactment of the 1875 Act, but it did many of the same things, outlawing private discrimination and accommodations, that sort of thing. And they did it not pursuant to the 14th Amendment, not pursuant to the 13th Amendment, not pursuant to the 15th Amendment, but pursuant to the commerce power.
Right.
Which just seems to make no sense at all. But, you know, Congress has this extraordinary authority to regulate commerce. And Johnson was able to persuade Congress, and ultimately Congress enacted a statute that withstood Supreme Court scrutiny that said racial discrimination negatively affects commerce.
Right.
And because you can be whatever color you wish, but your money is still green. And if you prevent African Americans from freely traveling, from buying food at restaurants, from staying overnight at a hotel, that depresses economic growth. And Congress was within its power to say, well, we're going to do this. And isn't that an interesting anomaly in constitutional history?
It is. It is because it just shows that the federal government can create rights if they want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because of the separation of powers, they certainly can find a way to craft the language if they want to.
Right.
And that, honestly, that to me, that's the shame of Jim Crow, is that so many people in power in the federal and state governments turned a blind eye to what was going on, mm-hmm. to the plight of the African American that had toiled for so many years, hundreds of years, as slaves in this country. And if they had not done that, then I think that the economic situation that we faced for a number of years in the African American community would not have existed. The lack of education would not have existed. The broken homes would not have existed. A lot of a number of negative things, I'll say, would not have existed. And it was because, you know, Johnson found a way to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to overcome that, historic wrong. And of course, but unfortunately, we had to continue to fight for it. But at least, and if you look at the juxtaposition between 1875 or that era,
mm-hmm.
What Johnson did, the federal government, I'll do the connection this way. If you look at the era of the Black Codes with what Johnson did, Black Codes ended because the federal government said, we're not going to let this happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing occurred in 1964. The federal government said, finally, we're not going to let this happen. When the federal government turned its back on African Americans, that's when the rights were taken away.
And 90 years, roughly. You know, the federal government tried to do the right thing in 1875.
Right.
In fact, that really was what Reconstruction was all about. We're going to have to do a whole different show on Reconstruction because there's a lot of mythology about that.
Yeah.
But that's ultimately what it was about. How do you reintegrate, you know, the former Confederacy back into the Union, and how do you establish full citizenship for all these former slaves? And the federal government tried to do the right thing in 1875, and ultimately that failed. It failed because of the court, but it failed ultimately because of political will.
Right.
And for the next 90 years, if you count up to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the federal government turned its back on the issue of racial justice. Or maybe the next 80 years if you go to Brown in 1954.
Right.
But for a number of decades, the federal government didn't do anything. But when the federal government did decide to act, that's when things started to get better.
Yes. And you know, some say that the civil rights movement ended with Martin Luther King's assassination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are arguments that it continues until everyone has received their full civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an important period of time. And actually, I think that was the most significant blow to ending Jim Crow.
What was the most significant blow?
The culmination of the Civil Rights era.
Uh-huh, okay.
Was the most significant blow when blacks had achieved the level of rights that they achieved at that time.
Now, okay.
You know, there of course has been discrimination in the country that has continued to this day, and you know, as I said, the human trafficking still occurs.
Mm-hmm.
For example. But Jim Crow, in my mind, really died with Martin Luther King. when he became a martyr, because there was no stopping people from experiencing the individuality that we're all entitled to. I think that no one was willing to allow themselves to be subjugated anymore from that point forward, because someone had made a sacrifice, and I think that's what is significant about Martin Luther King's life. I have a theory about what happens after that in terms of black culture and black life. I think we got a little too carried away with it.
Go on. In fact, I want to return to something you mentioned before. You know, what in your mind is the, in your opinion, is the legacy of Jim Crow? What are the modern manifestations? You said it was killed, but ultimately still there are effects that are going on.
This is still the specter of Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. As I said, the law in Arizona concerning immigration, trying to stop people who are perceived as being Hispanic and being able to check for their green card. I think that is a manifestation of Jim Crowism, because we're marginalizing people. We're identifying. We're racial profiling people in a way to say you're not entitled to this right. And unfortunately, I think that has a lot to do with the political issues that we face these days. The conflict between the parties, the Republicans and the Democrats and the Tea Party and all of that, labels, all of these labels that we like to apply, is something that has allowed people to marginalize people, as I used previously. For example, the whole issue of gay rights, you know, another way just to divide people, you know. Quite frankly, I don't care what someone does behind closed doors. If that's their individual right, if they're adults. But I think that we now have ways of pointing the finger at somebody else and saying it's your fault. Instead of taking collective responsibility for where we are and trying to deal with the real big picture and the real issues that exist in this world today. We need to actually have a revival in some sorts of civil rights, whether it's called civil rights or human rights today. I know I was the first was a generation that benefited from affirmative action programs. You know, now we don't even recognize that there are historic wrongs that still haven't been corrected. And there's like the education disparity in some of our cities. I could give other examples, but then I'd be going on for days.
No, I understand. In fact, that reminds me, we've been talking for a while, and so we probably should bring this to a close. But, Derek, we'll have to have you on the show again at some point, because there are obviously lots of other important issues here to be discussed as well. And I think we've just scratched the surface, but I thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. We've been talking with Professor Derek Howard of the Appalachian School of Law, all about Jim Crow. After the break, we'll pick up with Professor James W. Lowen, who has written a book called Sundown Towns. Stay tuned.
Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where today we're discussing the compelling subject of Jim Crow and its constitutional significance. We were just talking to Professor Derek Howard of the Appalachian School of Law, and now we'd like to speak to Professor James W. Lowen, the best-selling author of the books Lies My Teacher Told Me and Lies Across America. He's also written a book called Sundown Towns, about one aspect of Jim Crow that you may not be aware of. Welcome again to the program, James W. Lowen.
Well, hi. Thanks for having me.
What is a sundown town, and what have you written about it?
A sundown town is a town that for decades was, and some of them still are, all white on purpose. And they get their name from the fact that, well, for example, I'm told, pretty reliably told, I think, that Buchanan County in western Virginia had a sign at its edge that said, and quote, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in Buchanan County."
Oh, my goodness.
The same sign graced, or maybe we should say disgraced, Manitowoc, Wisconsin, which is a sizable city on the edge of Lake Michigan, about 30, 40 miles north of Milwaukee. The same sign graced Hawthorne, California, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. The same sign was at the gates of Pena, Illinois, in the center of Illinois. Now, you don't have to have a sign to be a sundown town, and in fact, most sundown towns and counties never had a sign. All you have to have is the policy, formally or informally, that black folks can't live there. And I should add, in the West, sometimes it was Chinese Americans who couldn't live there, or Native Americans, and in suburbs across the country, sometimes it was Jewish Americans, as well as blacks, who couldn't live there.
Okay, so we're talking about places where it's, I guess, not considered advisable to restrict minorities during daylight hours, because, of course, that's when you need them to show up and do the heavy lifting.
Yes.
So you're welcome to come during the day and work in the garden, or work in the kitchen, or scrub the floors, but that's all. And by the time the sun is setting, you need to be on your way back to wherever it is you live.
There's even the case, for instance, in Pekin, Illinois, which is a city of about 30, 35,000 people. Pekin has, among other employers, a rather large power plant. I think it's Commonwealth Edison. And black folks who were in the night shift were followed by the police when they came into town. I think that's 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. Until they turned into the parking lot for Commonwealth Ed. Then we realized, okay, well, they're not sleeping. They're working, so that's okay. And I also should add that there are sundown towns, or there were anyway, where black folks were not even safe during the day. For instance, in Ironwood, Michigan, which is way up in the UP, the Upper Peninsula,
sure.
It turns out that Pullman porters, of course, that was one of the better jobs that blacks could get back in the nadir of race relations between 1890 and 1940, when we went so racist as a country. Well, they could not safely step off the train, even during the day, to get some fresh air or have a cigarette or whatever, see the sunlight in Ironwood, without possibly being stoned. And I don't mean, you know what I mean,
yeah,
having rocks thrown at them, that
right,
kind of stoned. But generally speaking, it's what you said. We're happy to have you be a maid. We're happy to have you be a janitor in the local industry, but you have to be gone by dark.
Now, when did this phenomenon begin in our country?
It mostly began around 1890. Not very many people realize that beginning in exactly 1890 was what we call the nadir of race relations. Nadir, of course, means low point. At this point, the United States went more racist than at any other time, and sundown towns swept across. Now, I grew up in central Illinois. When I finally decided to write a book about this, which was in 1999, I knew I was going to do more research on this subject in Illinois than in any other single state, although I did a fair amount in North Carolina, Arkansas, quite a bit in Indiana, Oregon, all across the country, but more in Illinois. I thought I would discover maybe 10 sundown towns in Illinois and maybe 50 across the country. Not so. I have no idea. I am now at a count of 504 sundown towns.
Wow.
In Illinois alone, which is 70% of all the towns that there are in Illinois, and I think a similar percentage occurred in Indiana, in Oregon, and in various other northern states. Now, southern states didn't do it nearly as much, except in Appalachia, the Ozarks, and the Florida coastline. We might say those are the kind of non-South parts of the South.
Mm-hmm.
And it's particularly ironic because in Appalachia, and for that matter in the Ozarks, many of these entire counties, and certainly many communities, were unionist during the Civil War.
Yeah, this is really striking a strange chord because, of course, most people tend to identify anti-black racism with the South, fairly or unfairly. And yet you're telling me that it's in the non-southern portions of the country that this phenomenon of the sundown town was more common. Now, why do you think that is?
Well, I lived in Mississippi for 8 years, and so I tried to find every sundown town I could in Mississippi. And I found three.
Three?
That compares to 504 in Illinois. So that's quite a difference. I think the reason is simply that during the Nader, Northerners came to rationalize the fact that the South was not giving even formally equal rights to black folks. They had taken away the right to vote, the right to be on juries, and so on, beginning in Mississippi and sweeping through all the southern states and even Oklahoma. And the North did nothing about it. So that makes the North complicit. But meanwhile, we've got to rationalize that. And so I think we rationalized it by saying, well, yeah, they are inferior. And then the next step comes in. Well, if they're inferior, why do we let them in? Let's not let them in. And so town after town across the Midwest, for instance, and in the West, and suburb after suburb, suburbs became sundown mainly between 1905 and as late as 1968, decided, well, we're just going to make the entire town white only. After all, these people are inferior. Why do we need them? Now, in the South, it's a different kind of race relations. I mean, who's going to be the maid? Who's going to be the janitor? I actually have cases in my book. I wrote the book, Sundown Towns.
Right.
And it tells this story. And I have cases in the book of, for instance, a rich white family from Alabama that moves to Indiana, and they have to send their maid back down to Alabama lest she be killed. Now, they think this is crazy. You know, what's the matter with you people? Who's going to be your maid? It's a different style of race relations, but it certainly gets the South off the hook for being the only place where race relations are particularly harsh.
Other parts of the country simply didn't, you know, the white population perhaps did not have the same experience with black people. I wonder if this is just a reaction of some northern areas to out-migration of blacks.
Not exactly. It turns out out-migration of black folks from the South really began during the Civil War. People don't realize this. We think of the time of the Great Migration, and the Great Migration began in 1915 during World War I, because northern industry started to boom then, and really continued up until the 60s, maybe the late 60s. But black folks were moving north as soon as 1863. For instance, in the West, Caro, Illinois, which is right down at the very bottom tip of Illinois, Caro became a huge staging ground for the Civil War in the West. It was, of course, on the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. And so all kinds of refugees, wounded civilians, wounded veterans, wound up back in Caro. And Caro swells to two or three times its population and takes in all kinds of black folks, because, of course, African Americans are fleeing to the United States forces. Well, the United States didn't know what to do with them, so they couldn't leave them all in Caro. So they actually tried to disperse them all over the place. And furthermore, black folks on their own wanted to go all over the place, see the world now that they were no longer slaves. So I show in my book, Sundown Towns, that by 1890, African Americans have made it to every county in Montana. They've made it to every county in Indiana but one. They've made it all across the place. But then, between 1890 and 1940, they get driven from at least 10 counties in Indiana. They wind up only in the largest cities in the West. And Chinese before them get driven out. See, this is the part that particularly amazed me. Until I wrote Sundown Towns, I just thought it was somehow natural that Chinese Americans wound up in big city Chinatowns like New York and Chicago and San Francisco. After all, they had left through one of the biggest cities in China, Canton, a few of them from Hong Kong. They had come in through the biggest city in the West at the time, namely San Francisco. But it wasn't natural at all. It turns out that in 1870, Chinese were all over the place in the West. They made up, for instance, 19% of the population of Idaho.
Idaho? That is remarkable.
They get driven from almost every county in Idaho. They get driven from every single county in Wyoming except one. They get driven from over 50 towns in California. They even get driven from big cities like Tacoma, Washington. And the same thing happened to black folks about 10 years later. Between 1890 and 1940, they get driven from town after town in Indiana, for instance. So they wind up in just maybe a handful of places. Gary, Indianapolis, Evansville, French Lick. They're not all big places.
Right.
But just a handful, nevertheless.
Now, were there ever any constitutional challenges to this? Were there court cases where the
Of course illegal.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty clear violation.
You know, but the Constitution was not being enforced. If black folks are supposed to have equal rights under the Constitution, which is what the 14th Amendment says, and voting rights under the Constitution, which is what the 15th Amendment says, well, then how in the world can Mississippi pass a law and all the other southern states follow suit, essentially removing those rights? It even turns out that there is a decision on this matter, a constitutional decision, right in the middle of an eight-year period, 1917. This is the case Buchanan v. Worley. And in this case, coming out of St. Louis, I think, or possibly Louisville, this is a case against the so-called segregation ordinances that middle American cities like Louisville, St. Louis, Norfolk, I believe, Baltimore, and also some southern cities like New Orleans had been passing. Chattanooga passed it. And what these say is that no black person can move onto any block in the city that is majority white, and no white person can move to any block in the city that is majority black. So see, it's allegedly equal. Well, of course, it was only enforced one way. And furthermore, if you just wait a few years, that means that you're going to have complete apartheid within every city because, you know, in the long run, we're all dead and people do move. Black folks took this to court. I think, as I say, the case came out of St. Louis, but it might have been Louisville. I'm not quite sure. And the Supreme Court, even during the nadir of racial relations, found for the NAACP and for the white plaintiffs, because it turns out that a white right was being infringed upon. And here's how it went. Let's suppose you own a house, and in today's terms, it's worth $100,000. But you're willing to sell it to a black person, and black folks aren't allowed to live in most of the city, but they can buy your house. Well, naturally, black folks are going to be willing to pay $110,000 for it, but you can't sell it to them because it's on a white block. Therefore, your right, your white right to that extra $10,000, that your right to dispose of your property as you see fit, we might put it too, has been infringed upon. The Supreme Court said, no, these are unconstitutional. Well, if that's unconstitutional, then, of course, it's even more unconstitutional to have a city ordinance, which many towns passed, that blacks flatly can't live in the city. But nobody took it to court because they, you know, they were terrorized out of the city in the first place.
So there weren't a lot of court cases striking these down. So what? I don't think that there are as many sundown towns today as there were at this time. So what accounts for their gradual disappearance?
Well, they haven't disappeared. I have to say that people assume that they've disappeared. 2 years ago, for instance, I was in Calhoun County, Illinois, which is north of St. Louis. Calhoun County does not have a single black family in it, or at least it didn't as of 2 years ago when I was there. And it's been an infamous sundown county for many decades. And it's not even the worst county in Illinois. So there are entire counties where it is not prudent for black families to now live, and none do.
Now, is this just a historical residue, or is there actual discouragement of black families from moving in?
You move in, and you have a second grader, let's say. And you send your kid to school on the first day of school. And before he gets to school, on his route between the school bus and the school, he gets beaten up. Do you stay? How many days do you stay? You know? Or you get a brick thrown through your picture window, and the police come to investigate, and they say, well, this is a shame, but what do you expect? Do you stay? You don't stay.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're essentially at a civil rights demonstration, but you're there 12, 7, 365. You know, you're there 24-7, whatever the phrase is. You're there the whole day.
Right.
You can't go home from that demonstration. So that's how they stay that way. Now, I think a lot of them have given it up. Grundy gave it up. Grundy was a sundown town. In fact, all of Buchanan County in far western Virginia was sundown. There's several sundown counties in North Carolina. And some of them have given it up, and I think some of them have not. I don't think we can know for sure until a courageous black family moves in, and either they get along or they don't get along. I think the reason some of them have given it up is that the times they are changing. I mean, we do have a black president. But then on the other hand, ironically, I asked people of goodwill in Calhoun County if they thought black folks could move in at this point. And that was 3 months after Obama had taken office. And the advice I got was, well, no, not yet. Maybe in 2 or 3 years, if Obama works some miracles.
Wow.
Maybe then. And ironically, this county, which does not allow blacks to live in it, or didn't then, voted for Obama 53-46 which is exactly how the U.S. voted for him.
Right. Well, without challenging anything you said about Buchanan County in the past, I do have to tell you of one institution locally that bucks the trend and makes me very proud. There's a local religious institution, the Mountain Mission School, which is a school and also a home, a boarding school for underprivileged children, currently has a population of children there who are overwhelmingly of African descent.
Yeah.
Has never discriminated, and indeed they tell the story there about the founder of the school, a fellow by the name of Sam Hurley, who back in the 1940s actually was educating and housing a young black boy. And the authorities came to him and told him he was violating Virginia law and that he needed to give this kid over. And he denied the kid was there. He hid the kid until the authorities went away and educated him and housed him for years in defiance of Virginia segregation laws.
Yeah, fascinating. But I have to say that wasn't a statewide law. That was a local ordinance.
Well, certainly. But there was certainly statewide segregation in Virginia back in the 40s as well.
Sure.
So there were all sorts of problems that were caused there. So even though, you know, there could be such things happening in sundown towns and sundown counties, there were always some brave people on the other side of the issue as well.
True. That's certainly true. And furthermore, there's interesting people who came from them. My case in point, there's various cases in point you can use, but John Wooden, the most famous college basketball coach of all time, and the winningest, he got along okay with black folks. You know, he got along okay with not only Lou Alcindor, but also Lou Alcindor after he changed his name. What did he change his name to?
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yes, I had a
thank you, Wayne, there. Our producer, chiming in. He's the only fellow here with any sports knowledge at all.
I'm glad he's there. So Wooden did just fine. He got along fine with everybody. But Wooden came from Martinsville, Indiana, which is a notorious sundown town in Indiana. So you don't have to be racist because you live in a sundown town. But I would submit, nevertheless, those people who are hearing this broadcast, if you know that your town used to be, and who knows if it still is, but used to be unwelcoming to blacks, please let me know. Email me, jlowen, J-L-O-E-W-E-N, at uvm.edu, and let me know more about it. Because at my website, even though the book Sundown Towns came out several years ago, I'm still trying to identify and out every last sundown town in America. I think it's the first step towards getting them on the road to dealing with it.
Okay, and what's your website?
The easiest way to find my website is to type my name, James W. Lowen, L-O-E-W-E-N, into Google, and it comes up first.
So we can Google you and find your website, or we can email you at jlowen@uvm.edu.
Now, I might say at my website, you can go to the Sundown Towns page, and there's an interactive map of the U.S., and you can click on whatever state interests you, and then see what I know about that state. A whole bunch of hyperlinks come up about every town I know of. Now, if your town isn't on the list, that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be on the list. It just means I'm only one person and I haven't learned about it yet. So, again, I still want to hear from you.
All right. Well, James W. Lowen, thank you so much for talking with us about sundown towns. And at some point in the future, no doubt I'll be calling you again to talk about some of your other fascinating research.
Well, I hope to hear from your listeners. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Professor James W. Lowen and Professor Derek Howard of the Appalachian School of Law for talking with us today about the very sad and poignant subject of Jim Crow. My name is Stuart Harris. Remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
Blood on the leaves and blood at the roof. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the